It's interesting you say that. I had a feeling what this was about, because I think I got, and I think you probably did too, the little CD from Sunstone that had some snippets on it from the most recent symposium. And it talked about this unique idea or best idea in Mormonism. And I knew it wasn't supposed to be like the pillars of our faith, which we've done before, which I was grateful because I don't think that I could rise to that level. In fact, I think this is probably going to be the equivalent of a Sunstone 2.5 minute talk. But, when I listened to the things that people said on the CD, I was impressed by their feeling and the depth of thought. And so I hope I can share something that's important and worthwhile. The one thing that I've thought of over the years, and I've actually thought of this a lot of times over the years, is the number of good people that I've been associated with in the church. It just seems like I've been very fortunate that at every level, from when I was young until now, priesthood leaders, teachers, you know, everybody that I've had something to do with were just good, decent people trying to do the right thing. I have literally never had a bad experience with a priesthood leader, never had a bad experience with a crabby Sunday school teacher or scoutmaster or anything. So what it said to me is that a couple of things. First of all, lay service in the church is really important. It's not unique to us, and really every church can only exist by the service of the laity. I mean, there's some churches that pay a priest or minister, or pay their organist or a church secretary, but basically it's just the willingness of ordinary people to keep it going. And people serve for all kinds of reasons. They want to be part of the group. They want to do their share. They want to feel needed. People want to serve God in some way or another. But I think that the thing that makes us unique is that when people serve in the church, it's because they have the belief that they've been called to serve. By and large, people don't either volunteer, seek, or aspire to position. I mean, I know some people do. I have an acquaintance who told me one time in confidence that he wouldn't mind being a bishop. I thought he ought to be medicated. He was a bishop's counselor at the time, and he later became a bishop, and as far as I know, he was a very successful bishop. You know, it could have just as well been the case that he never would have been called, but he was a good, decent man, and, you know, the opportunity arose, and he was willing to step up and serve. When we're called, people make certain assumptions. First of all, we assume that when we're being called to something, that there's a true need. And whether that's as the third assistant songbook stacker, or whether it's Relief Society president or whatever, that there's a true need that needs to be filled. Now, it may be a need on behalf of the church, it may be a need for the person, but there's a true need. And the other thing is that the people calling you have your best interest at heart. Now, people, when they receive a call, don't always necessarily believe that it was, you know, writ on the bishop's office wall by the finger of God that you should be the third assistant songbook stacker. But, you know, generally we do believe that it was at the least a really good idea, and at the best truly, you know, truly inspired. Sometimes callings can seem a little strange when they come to us. And I've been in the position of issuing callings in the past, and on at least two occasions, I've had people ask me what I've been smoking. The first lady looked at me with this incredulous look and says, "Does the bishop have any idea what I do?" And I didn't have any idea what she did. But the bishop had okayed the call, and so I said, "Yes, he does." And she did great. And she not only did great in her calling, she went on to other things, went to the temple with her family. So Another time it happened, the guy looked at me, and it was clear that he thought I was off my rocker, and as he looked at me, I thought, you know, this is the wrong calling. And as I sat there and stared at him in that few seconds, I suddenly realized what the right calling was. I said, "Don't move. ran around the church, talked to everybody, came back and called him to the calling that he should have. It worked out really well. So, sometimes people accept callings out of guilt. You know, we've all been in that position where never turn down a calling. I can't turn down a calling. And they grow into it. Sometimes they turn out to be just slackers. But, you know, most of the time when people say they will, or when we receive a call, we figure, well, okay, you know, I'm willing to step up. And I think when everything is ideally there, you know, in this situation, when we're actually called to do something in the church, I think that that's one of the things that makes us absolutely unique. And that's my talk.
About not being able to come to hear you all, your family, was Julia, who is herself quite an accomplished musician. She said, I just wanted so badly to come hear the Pixton family. So, Julia Mumford has been with us on and off over the years. She and her husband Tom live in Bellingham now. She teaches music and is very active in the church and busy raising four boys. And her husband's an attorney. And every couple of years, every few years, we get one of them on the program because they're a very talented, wonderful young couple. this was her contribution to the best idea in Mormonism. One of the best ideas in Mormonism, in my opinion, comes straight out of the fifth article of faith. We believe that a man must be called of God. Except that I would like to change just one word. We believe that a man may be called of God. I am, by the way, also assuming, or women. We believe that people without training or prior experience can be called to lead organizations, balance ward budgets, teach classes, set up satellite and audiovisual equipment, manage records, organize activities, speak in public, and so on. Of course, we've all seen some of the chaos that can result, and I'm not denying the flaws inherent in this particular good idea, but it's my favorite because of the effects on both the individuals called and the organizations they serve. When we lived in Costa Rica, I was called to be a primary president, in spite of not speaking Spanish. One of those soon called as a teacher in the primary was a recently baptized Nicaraguan woman in her mid-50s. She was probably an illegal immigrant, and she worked as a domestic to support her son and his family, along with two granddaughters she had brought with her. She was a big, strong woman. She'd suffered plenty, and she seemed almost impervious to calamity. She was confident and determined, but otherwise unqualified as a teacher. My introducing her to the lesson manual and the concept of teaching a class was the blind leading the lame. I could not speak Spanish. She, though she could read, had no formal education, none at all. Still, with some help from Tom, we managed to understand each other, and I helped her plan to teach her first lesson. My son Zach was in her class. He thought she was a great teacher. Her classroom control was good. She told interesting stories. He liked going to class. Every week I asked what she had taught. Each week he answered about Samuel. His Spanish wasn't so good, and I assumed that he was just not understanding the lesson. But after a month or so, I decided to investigate further and discovered that she indeed was teaching that sample lesson over and over again, week after week. I had neglected to tell her to go on to the next lesson. I love this story for so many reasons, but mostly because it illustrates how far Hermana Celis had to go to become a teacher. She didn't have any idea about what a class should be like. I didn't train her very well. She had to figure out how to do the job using her observations of other church leaders, the manual, conversations, whatever she could scrounge up. And yet she learned to teach a decent class. She passed along information. She became a teacher, at least at church. This pattern is one I've seen in England, Taiwan, Japan, and even here in the US, everywhere I've lived. New converts, mostly poor, mostly with limited opportunities, are called to do something well outside their range of competence. They rise to the challenge, often discovering for the first time that they have the capacity to learn. Many become consumed by the desire to become educated. One delightful elderly woman I knew in England filled many journals with her discoveries and musings. Another man served on the High Council and made himself into a fine orator. I remember some of his sermons lasting well over an hour. Often as these people discover their latent talents, they also notice opportunities for further career education and increase both salary and opportunity at work. The flip side, of course, is the effect they have on the organizations they serve. Untrained people can cause havoc in an organization, but they can also see things fresh. They have no ingrained traditions, no internalized unspoken rules to follow. The result is unpolished, inefficient, frustratingly random at times, but also living, breathing, and delightful. I love to be a part of little branches and less traditional wards because so much of this experience is collected in them. There is a sense of adventure and fun that can't be found anywhere else. In our little branch in Japan, for example, the branch president instituted a 30-minute socializing time between sacrament meeting and Sunday school. In another small ward, the Relief Society president and Elders Quorum president addressed low visiting and home teaching rates by instituting a round-robin night, where everyone would come to the church and both do and receive home and visiting teaching in just one frantic hour. I accept that this best thing has its flaws, some of them almost fatal. What happens when the teacher can't learn to teach a decent Sunday school lesson, or the audiovisual coordinator can never tune in a broadcast signal? One ward financial secretary I knew decided to close out the books early by changing the date on the computer. The resulting meltdown led to days of talks with the church's auditing department. And yet I still choose this as my best idea, because at heart I would rather live with the chaos of a ward full of people who are trying to figure everything out than with the rigidity of one where members all know how it's supposed to be done. Save me from the experience, tradition, unwritten rules, certainty. Give me the inherent possibilities involved in the idea that we believe that a man may be called of God to try to do just about anything. That's joyous. And now it's your turn. You have to come to the mic because we are taping. But I know some of you have done some good thinking. Levi?
I've got an idea of something.
Come on up. Come on up. How do you?
Sorry.
No, that's all right. I don't know where to begin.
All right, thank you. My junior year at BYU, 1953-54, I filled my religion class requirement by taking a course called Mormon Ethics, taught by a French professor who taught on the side this religion class. His name was B.F. Cummings, Benjamin Franklin Cummings, and He's an uncle to Richard Cummings of Salt Lake that some of you know. But he was elderly, and his elderly wife roached his hair. He had a jagged haircut, and he was unkempt and spluttered when he became enthusiastic. But it was his enthusiasm that I loved. But his enthusiasm was over this idea. The idea, of course, familiar to most, is that the consciousness is eternal, that intelligence is eternal, the substance of the King Follett discourse that you're all aware of, that some of the unique features of Mormon theology derives from that. But the idea that the self has existed from all eternity with no beginning, no end. Cummings taught was such an elevating and ennobling idea that that it was the essence of Mormonism. And he said you couldn't believe in it without it making a better person of you. And he wrote a book and he wanted to publish it. And when I came back from my mission in 57, he was trying to publish it, but the church wouldn't. The church publication outlets wouldn't take it, and no one else would. And I pondered whether the idea is widely accepted in the sense that B.F. Cummings preached it to that class, that it was so ennobling and elevating that merely to believe it would alter your life. And it seems to me that I don't see the Latter-day Saints pursuing that, and yet it strikes me as I'm reminding you of it in the name of B.F. Cummings as the single greatest idea of Mormonism. Thank you.
Dan, you've been doing some thinking. How about you? Yeah, you. That Dan.
You said you did. You did thinking. Just to let you know, this was a session format. You know how we have pillars of my faith and stuff that we invented a couple years ago. Any of you aware of John Rawls and his theory of justice and stuff? And one of the things that I think that's helpful as we ponder this sort of question is to put ourselves in what he calls an original position. A position as if it's before the world were created, before the realities of the political climate were there. And basically what he says is that he basically says if you were a person and you got together with other people and you were to design a world that would be the most fair to the most people or whatever, but you didn't know what position you were going to take in that world, you know, what would you come up with? And so that's where his theory of justice comes from. So I think this is kind of fun in this best idea in Mormonism to almost free ourselves from, like, how would that play in church, and to kind of think about this, just really what ideas really come up for you, and regardless of the consequences within the church itself. So I don't know if that makes any sense to you at all, but in other words, you're like, if you really like this whole idea of eternal progression, you should be able to say that out loud, whereas sometimes we might not otherwise. So anyway, as anybody ponders their own thoughts. I told Molly 3 or 4 days ago, it's on my brain too, but really whatever's on my brain ends up in my editorials. if I were to have to pick something, it really does fit with Levi's sort of sense here that if we are eternal, my favorite scripture, just to let you know, is it's in section 93, verse 29-30 and stuff, but it's the whole idea that truth acts for itself. In other words, I'm trying to come up with the words for it. in which God has placed it, all truth is independent in that sphere in which God has placed it to act for itself as all intelligence also. And it's this idea that if we find something in the world that has an attractive power, that power should be honored to the best degree that it can. And so to me, if that were, and this idea that it's eternal, because see, we've got the advantage on this one, because if God didn't create things, if we're all co-eternal with God, then we really are dealing with something like this, whereas if God created ex nihilo or something, you kind of can get a sense that, well, God gave it that power, God, you know, God did this and God did that. But no, if it's bottom-up, grassroots, kind of cool truth bubbling up that sort of has light, and light attracts light, and people get together and they start talking about it and all that stuff. I really like this sort of idea of eternal truth bubbling up and honoring it. And so my whole editorial this time in the new issue, and just really what's been on my mind lately, is that attraction of the particular. You know, we're big on the big ideas. Oh well, what's a good big idea? Honesty is the best policy, you know. Or we do these universal truths. But what's the most interesting to me is the particular truths. You know, I love everybody. Great idea, but what's the real hard? The hard thing is to do what? To love that guy and that guy, you know, and her and that, and it's the whole particulars is where it is. And so this idea of Mormonism drawing us to whoever we meet, the light that's in them, the truth that's in them, the power that they have, being something for me to honor. And then, again, once more, out of that, kind of being able to, now I'm much more informed when I do, kind of do more and more grand, my grand pronouncements about truth. Truth informed by particularity that's eternal. So maybe that would be where I'd be. Thanks.
Charlotte. For the tape, this is Charlotte England.
Well, I totally agree with who mentioned the lay church. I just think it's one of the greatest things going for us. And of course, we end up getting jobs we never dreamed we would do or could do. But I've gained an appreciation of so many people that you wouldn't normally choose for company or for socializing with or that sort of thing. And you're put on a committee with them, or you're a counselor with them in a whatever organization. And you just gain such a different appreciation. And as you get to know this person, you get to love this person. And it isn't that they are different than they were before. It's just that you yourself change, your heart changes in this experience. Consequently, after I had been working with on putting on little performances in the ward, you know, getting, I mean, we even made up our own scripts and we put on plays and things. Well, in this wonderful lay experience, I got called to be the cultural specialist or something like this in the ward. So what they did was make official my job that I've been doing for a couple of years already. And so I just, one thing that I found in this, the old road show isn't around anymore, but it was such a fun experience that I recall. I know it was a lot of work for the leaders and the people taking us around in trucks and cars and scenery and everything and moving around, but I wanted to capture some of that spirit, and I wanted to involve the bishopric as well, especially because I felt that if we had them in there, that, you know, that you'd have the whole ward basically. And so one of the first kind of silly plays we did was it was a Mother Goose play, and she gets things all kind of fouled up in this. But anyway, I asked the bishopric if they'd be the three pigs, and one of them was just very kind of shy and everything. So I had to kind of convert them to this whole thing, and they came through. It was so fun, and I just thought, you know, how else do you have this kind of experience when you've got somebody who's a businessman, somebody who's a rock collector, and I mean, it just all of them coming together and having a hilarious time. And so by the next season, or we do two or three plays a year, or some kind of a program, and by the next time they're willing to do the famous Grecian urn dance, which had been done years before, and then they stopped doing any of the plays, and someone had remembered this, and so we resurrected that, and they did the Grecian, and I'm telling you, you see a whole different side of these men who are up there leading you every Sunday, and they're out there in their togas and all this stuff and throwing water out over the audience and doing these silly dances. So I just think it's a side of our of the church that we don't get enough of. I think we don't have enough of that humor and that just down-to-earth kind of how do you describe it? I don't know. Robert Kirby comes off really well. He hits it right on the nail when we need it. And Levi gives us our stories of real people. And that's what we are. And so that to me has been one of the things that has been really, really a testimony, I think, of this great organization. I mean, with all of its weakness. Thank
Charlotte,
you.
Doesn't that Grecian urn dance need explanation?
I have to do that.
Do we have three volunteers?
Okay, you're on. Kathleen.
This is Kathleen Petty.
I hope this won't seem like a heretical idea, but I really think home teaching and visiting teaching are a great idea in our church, when performed, of course. I mean, I know that it's hard to get out, but when I think of the experiences I've had on either end of it, the people I've met who I otherwise wouldn't have been exposed to, the chance to talk with them about a topic other than the price of gas, you know, we actually have sort of a spiritual discussion. And I think of home teacher we had when Chuck was a resident. He was really a very boring man, but he came every month and he always had something prepared. And I really so deeply appreciated that. You know, I have such tender thoughts of him, and he'll probably never know. I should probably tell him. So I think that that is a great strength of our church. And I think it really knits the ward together. And I think it makes us appreciate each other as sons and daughters of God on a separate and individual label. It has nothing whatever to do with the first impressions we have of people.
Okay, thanks.
You sure have the right side, oh my gosh.
Is that the best?
Okay. Yeah. So taking off on Dan's thought, so right up there at the beginning, if I were there, and going to make this marvelous place, and that's a whole story in itself, then put my, you know, these dear people down there, I know I would want, for I would know that there would be weak among them, and there would be needs of all kinds, and I would want for them to see each other's needs and take care of those without calling, without being called or asked. I might have to say something directly once in a while to somebody, but I find a great power. I know that's what I would want. That's what I want for my own children, and I see that they watch out for each other's needs. The particulars of this come through when I watch, when I see those needs, and I see this weak or struggling among us in different ways, physical, mental, emotional, and those different times in people's lives. And so we have triplet grandbabies. They're 17 months old. I felt so anxious before they were born. First of all, I didn't know if triplets would all come through okay. I thought so often something's wrong. And that was a whole waste of worry. They went home from the hospital with their mother. They were amazing. She was amazing. But the other piece of anxiety was, she's going to need me so much, and I work. And I don't think I have the energy for this. And so, of course, as you know, what would happen in a ward when triplets are born? They're adopted by the entire ward. People went over there and helped her care for them. There was even one night a week when someone went over so that they could sleep. Everybody held them, loved them, fed them. They brought meals over. It's not that I had to fight for time to be there at all. I'd go down whenever I felt like it and do what I could, but I knew they were taken care of. And then, of course, as time went on, you know, the help was withdrawn. They're 17 months now. They're still very, very active, but people still go. And meanwhile, I had to change my own. I was absolutely convinced I had to change my own work commitment in order to be able to help more. And then I also joined a gym so that I could have the energy to stand and to deal with it. Because there are two other grandchildren in town as well. But the really incredible thing is the outside of a calling, how people just come in and help. And then on a personal level too, the other direction, how at times I can completely sense somebody's need and be the channel for their help. One of the best things in the church.
Thank you. Kristen?
Hi, I'll make this kind of quick. I hope this is, I must be doing it okay. Okay. I remember when I was an undergraduate, we had a change in bishopric, and new bishop and his wife introduced themselves. This was at UCLA, and the bishop's wife, I think, was from New York City, if I remember correctly, and she had that pretty strong East Coast accent, and she was talking about her own conversion story, and one of the things that she found just so and heartening and just emboldening and stuff to her when she was taking the missionary discussions, they got to the concept of God the Father and the Godhead and everything, and I don't know if, well, I don't want to editorialize or conjecture too much, but I don't know, because I don't know the missionary discussions very well, or even the new ones or the old ones, but at one point, someone introduced the concept of Heavenly Mother to her, and I don't know if that's standard or not, but she said, oh, and there was a Mrs. God. And she was floored. She did, to her, this was just the best concept in any Christianity she had heard of. It never even struck her before. And so instead of just focusing just on the women, I would say just the concept of having deity that represents both genders, hopefully, you know, that would represent all of us, is pretty unique idea. And I know that you know, it causes a lot of debate, a lot of interesting discussions. People can sometimes be uplifted by it. Sometimes people can even be not uplifted by the discussion that ensues. But I still think it's a really wonderful concept.
Keep it rolling. We're doing well here. Okay. Marcia, and then Phil, then Ty. We got three now. We're on a roll. Marcia Benyangisi.
One of my top five concepts in our theology, and one I found an enormous help at a really grassroots level in raising children, is our belief that we chose to be here. Part of the bigger concept that we have had choice forever, which is truly the most marvelous of all concepts, I think, of our theology. But I find increasingly that it is also a sort of a strange comfort to me. I truly do believe that we had that choice and that others had that choice. And as I look around the world and the things that I've seen in just in my lifetime, and if I had to try to explain the injustices, the struggles that I read about and know about over the course of my life, and the great inequities there are in humankind, I'm not sure that I could ever come to terms with it if I didn't really believe that those souls also at some point had the choice and came here with an informed choice, knowing that there would be great injustices and immerciful acts, and that they would be subject to all those things. I still don't understand it. I can't conceive of the point when we will all be together and the Lord will, we will have the knowledge that will justify whatever those experiences were that were so bad for some people. that all of that will be justified sort of in the twinkling of an eye. That's a marvelous thing to try and comprehend. And that day will surely come. But in the meantime, I am grateful for the knowledge and for that I can turn to my children. They've never been able to say, I didn't ask to be here. It's never washed in our house. Never. Never been an excuse for anything. And on the very most elemental level, junior level, that's very handy. But the older I get, and the more experiences and more of the world that I've lived through, the greater that concept and more marvelous it is to me that someday there will be this reckoning and that we all chose to be here.
We'll get to hear from Phil McElmer again.
Less than an hour.
Less than an hour.
Although testimony meetings are often a parade of cliches punctuated by the bizarre, what a marvelous idea. It's an incredible idea. I, as a military chaplain, I've attended the worship services and meetings of many, many different churches. And I haven't been to any where an opportunity on a monthly basis is afforded any member of the church to address the congregation and to share what's on their heart and mind. It's a special, wonderful thing that's provided in the church. I wish we took better advantage of it. And I can remember when I first joined the church. I don't remember it so much now, but I remember first joining the church. At least every three or four testimonies, there would really be a heartfelt sharing of challenge, faith, a lesson in spiritual growth and development that was really transforming for so many in the congregation. And I wish we would take advantage of that opportunity and then play a role maybe in sharing a testimony, sharing an experience of spiritual growth that would help other members. And I'm grateful the church provides that opportunity for us.
This is someone I know well, my eldest son, Ty.
My question for Marcia is, what do you say when they say, I may have chosen to be here, but I didn't choose this family? to getting to the punchline, Levi already kind of stole my idea, but since I was going to say it, I paused for a while and figured I might as well get up here and at least flesh out my reason why the concept of intelligence has long been, I think, my favorite part of the gospel. I've been thinking about it a lot lately. I'm kind of a bizarre choice. I'm our ward mission leader. I chose not to go on a mission. And one of the things I believe, I've kind of recognized, is that my gospel, my testimony is founded very much on philosophy and theology, and that doesn't convert many people. You know, I marketing's a part of my job. It's I'm a real estate developer. You have to sell what you make, and you know, you kind of go for the fat part of the spectrum. So I do spend a lot of time kind of marketing the church on a spiritual basis, on a kind of connection to God basis, when I'm sitting here going, yeah, whatever. You know, think about the theology. Just sit down and think of the symmetry of it. And so as I've thought about that lately and why just not really hardwired to feel a very emotional connection with the church, why I keep coming, and I keep falling back to this idea that and not so much me now, but my daughters have this potential, that the little girl over there, who's almost five years old, can be this, you know, this mother in heaven, can be a God, and that I have this responsibility. at least for 18 years, and then I can I can goof off and do whatever with my free time. To teach her in the gospel and such a beautiful theology and such a beautiful practical way of life. And so when I think of why I show up on Sunday, I think that's it, that she has that potential, that she's a little God in embryo.
Thank you for sharing. Anyone else? Ah, yeah. Todd Kimball.
I sit in my own ward and think about testimony meeting, and I sit in a precarious place. I'm the marketing director for Signature Books, and I'm the publicist for Mike Quinn and Tom Murphy and Simon Southerton. and here I am, an active Latter-day Saint, and yet I sympathize greatly with these men and women. And so I wonder about what the great things are in Mormonism that keeps me. And I think about, you know, service and community. It's taken me 5 years, but I sit in Elders Quorum, and when I first started sitting in Elders Quorum, I'd raise my hand, and I always had a pretty good answer for stuff, or at least an answer for stuff. And as I've matured, I realized that you have to sort of sit in the back and mind your P's and Q's, and you may be cringing and so forth during lessons, but I find that as I provide service for my community and for my my ward brothers and sisters, that I build up a little bit of capital, and occasionally I can raise my hand and I can say something, and there'll be a little fight ensue maybe over after I say something. For example, the other day, the teacher was saying something about priesthood, and I said, and he was saying, oh, well, if he gave women the priesthood, and it was, what he was saying, it was just tanking, you know, and he was trying to say something smart, but it wasn't going well, and I raised my hand, and I'm in the very front, and I said, priesthood, and this is, maybe it's just me, but priesthood taught me to not respect the opinions of women, and I said an example of that is, look at the manual that's sitting in there in your hands. Show me a quote from a woman. And I said, you quote who you respect. And I kept my mouth shut. And someone, a lady in the back, sort of went after me, and I thought that was okay, but I kept my mouth shut. But I found that over the next few weeks, women and people in the ward who wouldn't give me the time of day would come up to me, and they would tease me about my kid, or they would tease me, like I saw a lifesaver sitting on the lost and found, thing, and there's, Tom, is that you? That's got to be yours, But it's interesting that these people weren't willing to stand up for themselves in the meeting, but they made it clear to me that they appreciated that I had done something on it. Here I thought I was burning a chit, and yet I was actually getting a little bit more status or acceptance. But it's like I said, it's the concept for me, the true thing for me within Mormonism is the concepts of service and a family. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Come on. Everyone survived. You see, they walk up, they walk down, they make it through alive. Good. Michael? Michael Stevens.
Well, actually, I've got five or six, but but it changes over the course of my life. If I'd done this 20 years ago, it would have been one topic. If I'd done it, 10 years ago, it would have been another. Several that have been mentioned already, the question of The King Follett Discourse, The Nature of Eternal Progression. Dan mentioned D&C 93 on the nature of truth and the glory of God being intelligence and all those kinds of things. The one that's been resonating with me most is actually kind of an extension of what a number of you have already said, and it has both practical and principle-based, manifestations. The practical side of the idea is that what I think is one of the best ideas in Mormonism is that you don't get to pick your ward. I mean, in a lot of ways, Charlotte, it's an extension of what you were saying, right? You don't get to pick your ward. You don't get to pick your calling. You know, Jesus said, love your neighbor. Oh, and by the way, if you're Mormon, you don't get to pick who your neighbor is, right? You gotta love the one not next to you at, you know, on the street, but the one sitting next to you in the pew. And because you can't gerrymander or, you know, attend wherever you want, you've got to work at it. And like Dan said, it is very hard work. The eternal, I think, principle behind that is the idea of Zion and the way that's laid out in the Pearl Great Price in the city of Enoch and those other places where we get a glimpse of the kind of society that is possible when we realize and begin to live the way that we're supposed to if we understand and embrace the power of this notion that you cannot pick the ward that you want to attend. You need to work at loving those people who are, in many ways, the most unlovable. But then I got volumes that my ex-wife and mother-in-law could speak to that about me. So we probably want to stop with that.
I was trying to think about what, not this, I don't think this is my favorite idea, but something that has come to me just sitting here thinking about it is, I'm kind of using the analogy, what's your name, Brother Pixton, whatever, Tom, used as about the power of the hymns kind of washing over the difficulties and some of the controversies and stuff. For me, that's the power is kind of in the memories of the community and the things that touch me spiritually that kind of have that same effect for me. And so I was sitting here and I've just been taking notes on these wonderful ideas from everyone just to kind of jog my memory and just to keep because I think they're so great. But I thought, okay, well, what are a few of my just quick memories of things that have touched me spiritually, kind of like the hymns. And they're simple. They're just basic, but yet they're not. They're profound because they're very human and they're very inspirational, but they're powerful. And they're just, some are big and some are little, but thinking of Madeline, how she plays the organ. You know, you've just never heard anything like it. If you've heard her play the organ, I took my little presidency, I teach the Maya maids in our ward, the 14 to 16-year-old girls, and I took them to our singles ward presentation of what was it called? Songs about the Book of Mormon and just kind of how they interpret into meanings for today. And it was very moving. It was very cool to see all these singles that had put forth that effort and to see my girls appreciate that. To see Steve go and play the piano because he's not comfortable playing the organ. He's one of the organists in our ward because there's only a few of them, and then somebody else comes up and just sits down and plays the piano at the same time. Just a very touching, cool thing that a lot of people appreciated. And Relief Society started a not-so-random acts of service to get people to interact and kind of practice kindness. And so someone picked my name, and she came by with a basket of her favorite things to share with me, and a list of her like favorite books and movie and season and dessert and all of that, and then gave me the same card and said, I'm really looking forward to getting yours, and then, you know, we can share that. And it was just, you know, a wonderful surprise on just a very ordinary day of running around and errands and typical stuff. Sweet and just very appreciated. Seeing a gentleman who was recently baptized in our ward, kind of that very rare neighbor who's just amazing, just a wonderful guy and family. His first time, I guess, blessing the sacrament is next to my son. And at the time, I was actually a ward missionary, which is quite a funny thing in itself. But I was involved in his whole situation before he was baptized, and then to see him doing that with my son was just very moving, just one of those great memories that washes over that. And then the last one is, John, I'll never forget your testimony before you left about our bishop, who had adopted two kind of older children, what, like 7, 8, who are now, one of his daughters in my maid class recently. From where? We moved in after?
From the Marshall Islands.
Marshall Islands. And it's quite a story in itself, but he talked about them coming to primary with just all this surgery on their teeth and, you know, everything that they had to go through to get those children healthy and up to speed. And you know, the bishop's just in the back wiping away tears, kind of embarrassed, but also it was just so moving. So it's just all those little memories of community and people trying to reach out and do the best they can and help each other in their human ways that kind of wash over the problematic things for me. Thanks. Oakland, Georgia, England. Do I need to hold?
Well, given to my own devices, I'm pretty lazy and selfish. On Sunday morning, I'd rather be at the coffee shop, and it's not that satisfying. I've tried it. And so for me, it's the long-term real satisfaction of being with a group of people that I disagree with, that I've decided to take on love instead of being right at church. And it's been a completely different experience for me. And now I see my ward as my community, and I see them as people who spent many hours on a lesson, and that everyone is just love to me. And that's really changed in the last. That's sort of a new thing for me, because I'm usually just picking things out. And I wanted to second who was talking about boundaries. I love that about the church. I just love that. And I think it's not talked about very much. Sort of take that for granted. But it is. And it's just a great concept, because the alternative is sort of the shopping around. But I just love the simplicity of looking at everybody in my ward as my community, and just love. It's very satisfying. More than but that's fun too.
How long will it be before we get you in our ward?
Pretty soon. We're in a ward that has all of the parents and who have children 12 and over in the entire state. So people get to move when their kids turn 12 and come into our ward so that we can have a massive youth of what? 20. That's all the youth in the state, 20. But we want you. I hope someone else. Yes, of course.
I'm Patricia Lawson. I'm from Bainbridge Island, but we used to live in Seattle State. It was a great experience. I've been thinking, oh, what could I share? Because everything has been shared, the greatest things, which for me is gaining love through service. But one thing I've been thinking of, I have two young children, a three-year-old and six-year-old, and it's motherhood for me. I love it, but it's really challenging. But this idea that you are my brother, and you are my sister, and you're my brother, and my children are my brother and my sister. And I have this responsibility that's been given to me to teach them. That's, I find, really, for me, elevates me beyond the daily cleaning of hands and preparing of food and reading stories. This is my brother and my sister that I am entrusted to teach them about their father and their mother and their brother, and to help them on their spiritual path as well as on their path to learning how to use this body that we've been given. So that's what I find as also a remarkable part of my cultural heritage and my religion.
John? Okay. Come on. John DeLynn.
So I'm really going to blaspheme today. How many of you grew up in a predominantly Mormon community? Okay. Well, I grew up in Texas, and not being in a Mormon community was a huge, important part of my identity. Rebellion was really popular in high school, and unhealthy rebellion was really popular. And so I derived a great amount of energy and satisfaction from being totally different. There were probably 10 Mormons in my high school of 400 people. And so I used to have this mantra that I'd say, be different in a positive way. And for me, Mormonism was the way that I expressed my uniqueness. And every once in a while, someone from Utah would move, and there would be this thing about Utah Mormons. And I would share a lot of that sentiment. And I would always feel how grateful I was that I didn't have to be raised in Utah, where the church was so common, and where people took it for granted and didn't take their covenant seriously, etc. When I went to BYU, I loved, BYU, but I really, really didn't like the student wards there. They felt very unnatural to me. And when my wife and I left BYU, we were just over, our hearts overflowed with joy. We waved with smiles as we left the valley. It was a beautiful rapture of elation. So we've lived in Chicago, we've lived in D.C., we've lived in Dallas, and we've lived in Seattle. And Seattle was a culmination. The ward in Seattle was by far the best ward we've ever lived in as a married couple. It was a phenomenal. The people in the ward on the Issaquah Plateau, it really was remarkable, the quality of people up there. So we loved it. But I had an experience in Seattle that became a real precursor to how I'm feeling right now about where we're living. But I took a new job at Microsoft when I was still here. And I met a bunch of people, including this guy named Piyush. He's from India. And so I was home one day. It was nighttime. and someone knocked on my door. And it was Piyush. I was like, Piyush, what are you doing? And he hands me some mail that was in his mailbox. And he said, oh, I just wanted to give you your mail. And I said, oh, well, wow, how'd you get my mail? And he said, I live next door to you. I've lived next door to you for 6 months. And that's been my experience in the places where I've lived. You never really get to know your neighbors. You know the people in your ward, and you may know a couple people, but most people you just don't know. And we've, you know, we lived in Salt Lake for a year before we moved to Seattle, and we found the neighborhood to be cliquey. We were turned off by it. We didn't like the ward at all. But my blasphemy is that I love living in Utah right now. I'm not saying I love it better than Seattle, but there's something really special about living in a community if it gets along well, if it treats each other with love, and where everybody can unite, not only in church and not only in the community and in the neighborhood, but also at church. And whether it's, you know, Shelby across the street who has four young boys, and she brings us cookies once a week, and we don't know why. She just brings us brownies or cookies, and we don't know why, but she does. And when we had to give our clothes away for our kids who have gotten older, we used to just give them to Goodwill. But how much more special it is to give them to Shelby, whose husband's a school teacher and she stays home, and we can, instead of just giving that to who knows who, to give it to someone we know. And then when Monica and Dustin have twins, that we can bring them a meal. And then probably the most inspirational thing that's happened since we've been there, there are two brothers that own a restoration service for when your home floods or gets caught on fire or whatever, they come and clean it up. And sure enough, a really bad rain happened in Logan and our basement flooded. And my home teacher happens to be Gerald, and I'm like, sweet, because I can call the guy who owns the restoration company. And so I, sure enough, I call Gerald and say, Gerald, come help me. And it's about 45 minutes, and I'm in the window well, bailing out my window well, because it's filling up with water and my basement's all flooded. And sure enough, Gerald comes over, and he comes and he teaches me how to rip up the carpet and pull out all the padding and mop up. And so at the end of that time, and he probably spent an hour with me, I go, well, man, thanks so much for coming, Gerald. And he goes, oh, yeah, no problem. Now I got to go do my basement. And the guy came and helped me before he even did his own basement. And so, you know, I know that you can have a horrible experience in Utah. I know that it can be petty and superficial and whatever. But if you think about a lot of the great people that we admire in the Sunstone Dialogue community, I think many of them grew up in that era. I've read biographies of like T. Edgar Lyon or Lowell Bunyan, and you read about what their communities were like when they were young. And I think that's what they experienced. And so I'm completely empathetic with those who might hate Utah or think it's a lame place or hated living there. I felt those things too. But I have seen a glimpse of what Zion can be by the convergence of a predominant religious community functioning that way. And so it may not last, and we may move, and we may end up hating it. As I come out of my Sunstone Dialogue sort of shell very publicly this next few months, maybe they'll all hate me, but I'm optimistic that there can be joy found even in Utah.
We'll connect you with some old Sunstone Dialogue people from Logan who are doing just fine, and they'll give you a little comfort. I don't know if Roy Bunyan or Catherine Bunyan are going to share with us here. They're both headed up.
Probably not Catherine.
You want to talk?
No.
No, I didn't think so. I hesitated coming up because I always get uncomfortable when there's a stream of same family members up in the front of the room. But John made me kind of organize my thoughts a little on some things I was thinking about with respect to this years ago, and I don't suspect he remembers much of it, but I was his bishop, and still have very fond memories about Houston, not because it was LDS, but because of the contrast that I could appreciate when we moved to Seattle. Houston is dominated by the Baptists and the Methodists primarily, and the tempo of the city is set by their majority. So their family night is Wednesday night. You can't hold baseball practices on Wednesday night. Nobody come because they're having their family night. And they take it seriously. They take it seriously in ways that it's hard for us to imagine. When they built Second Baptist Church out kind of beyond where our ward was located, the meeting house where the congregation gathers seats 8,000. And, it's televised. They have a rec center for families that has an Olympic-sized swimming pool, full-size basketball courts, a bowling alley, and a cinema.
And
roller skating rink. I forgot that, And it's quite a complex. And families can gather and do those things. When we moved back to Seattle in 1987, you can imagine the contrast. This is one of the more secular cities in the country. Sunday's just about like any other day of the week. All the stores are open. People go about business. They do things as if there is no church. And for the most part, there's very little church attendance. We don't have that. That's one of the reasons that drives me to endure the things that I find most frustrating when I participate in the gospel. And I can't really get rid of that. I do find a lot of it frustrating. But the sense of community and not doing what I do the rest of the week and the opportunity to meet with other people who hold their own infirmities and failings strongly enough that they want to gather to work on them together is important. I don't have a love-hate relationship with church. I have a love-frustration relationship with it. The frustration comes from the way your time is occupied and the inabilities to make much service out of it. I've kind of lost count, but I guess I've been on the High Council now for the last 5 years, something like that. And there have been occasions where my presence has been important and useful. But, I'm not sure that rises to 25% of the time, and I'm not even sure it's 10% of the time, because it's organized, like so much else in the church. There's a handbook, and you kind of follow the routine, and stepping outside of those boundaries is hard to do. I'm not running the show. I'm just there to kind of be the curmudgeon that objects to things and asks if there isn't a better idea and couldn't we go about it differently. And in our area, there's a lot of room for improvement of that nature. Somewhere around 25% of the members in our state go to church. The other 75% are out there, mostly uncontacted. A great many of them in our area are gay. And there's no program, and it's very hard to reach out. But just occasionally, these opportunities come up where there are things that can be done in a very positive manner. And that keeps you chugging along. And that's what brings some warmth and some joy into the process. We are needed, even if we don't appreciate it much. And the opportunities for service kind of lag behind the opportunities to be there and fulfill the programs, much of which don't provide service. They just chew up time. And there's so much at stake. We got guys like this, whose lives are really important if we set the good examples. Teach well, step outside the boundaries a little bit, cause people to think, and keep plugging along. I got a great deal of respect for my wife over here who spends countless hours. She's the intellectual in the family with respect to the importance of keeping groups like you together, and I see the real service of it. You found a way, quite frankly, that I can't find on the High Council to make a difference, and you all do, so if you bring at least one other person the next time she gathers in her home, as you can see, we still have room to fit more, and
there's another room downstairs. We could do breakout sessions.
That's right. And particularly if you can find some young people. It's nice to see a few of them here today. It's been really fun listening to you sing, listen to John talk. It's just it's been good to see some younger people here as well as those of us with gray hair.
We had no idea anyone on the High Council did participate in the gospel.
I hope that's inspired somebody else. Well, we're about ready to leave. I'll leave you with just one thought. I almost hesitate to add it because I think community has been the theme, and it's a really fine one. There, I have about five, too, so I'll only share one of them. But it is that we have no monopoly on truth, and all truth has not been revealed. And for me, that's a challenge to me individually, to look for truth wherever I can find it, to be open-minded and discerning and careful. And so I'm very comfortable talking with you all and anyone else about all the great issues that we face, because I think Mormonism tells us we must. And thank you all very much for coming. It's nice to have you.